lecture series. Professor Lusgaardin, you have the floor.
Thank you, and thank you for coming, and thank you for inviting me. I don't think I've ever given a lecture in a place quite this attractive. It's really rather lovely to have that garden over there. I've been told, when I was invited here, I was actually hoping to get an audience for the article I was drafting at that point. What I hadn't expected is we had to put it back, and I hadn't expected that the ICLQ was going to publish it as quickly as it has. So the full Monty, so to speak, was in the July, I guess it was, issue of the ICLQ. What I'm giving you is a stripped-down version of this, trying to keep it as closely as I can to 40 minutes to maximize the Q&A. And if I pass over things, hopefully it'll be picked up in the discussion. I should say something else too. I'm not an international lawyer by background. I'm a public lawyer with an interest in lots of things that are international. My generation anyway, though there were obvious exceptions to this, didn't take international law all that seriously. And I actually realized sometime around about in the 90s that if you're going to do anything in the areas of national security and broadly speaking, what I was interested in at the time, I wrote a book about, and the arms trade, which I was getting increasingly interested in from a domestic point of view, unless you understood something about international law, it was going to be hopeless. So with the great help of Dapo Akande, whose work I dare say some of you are familiar with, I managed to teach myself some international law, at least enough to work in this area. But it may be that some of what I say will strike you as missing some element because it's an international law bit I haven't come across, in which case I'd be more than happy to learn from you. Anyway, if I can then launch into this rather truncated version of what of the article. In April of 2013, an overwhelming majority of the UN General Assembly, which is 154 states, accepted a resolution approving the text of an arms trade treaty. There were only three states which opposed: Iran, North Korea, and Syria. This apparent overwhelming support was tempered by the abstention of 23 states, including some of the most important actors on the global stage. Nonetheless, it was an impressive moment. For the first time in world history, a truly global agreement reaching the transfer of restricting transfer of conventional weapons has been realized. Unlike atomic weapons and so-called pariah weapons such as CBW or cluster munitions, which had been subject to widely agreed international restrictions, conventional weapons are possessed by every state. That possession is intimately connected to the inherent right of self-defense, long recognized in international law and enshrined in Article 51 of the UN Charter. Moreover, commerce in them is extensive, lucrative, and energetically encouraged by the governments of states in which they are manufactured. Thus, the mere fact of a formal agreement, even if accompanied occasionally by an extravagant rhetoric, is more than worthy of note. So too is the extremely rapid movements toward making it operational. There was a signing ceremony in June of 2013 where 63 states proclaimed acceptance of it, but it actually came into force on Christmas Eve last year. It was remarkably fast, actually, and it is now in force and attracting ratifications as we go on. It is certainly possible that even a limited treaty can set in motion a cascade effect, which eventually produces national or international norms. There's research on this in relation to human rights. Yet once the undoubted normative significance of the mere existence of the ATT is acknowledged, the hard questions arise. What are its main purposes? How did it take the shape it did? What are its strengths and weaknesses? And most important, what practical effect is it likely to produce? Now, a thorough examination of the treaty requires treatment of a depth impossible to give here. I've therefore chosen to concentrate on the core, and this is what the handouts, which I assume you've got, cover. Article 2, which is the scope and the obligations it imposes on the state party, which are exporters, which are Article 6 and 7. I'll be making reference to these. The main issues I do not address are the substantially weaker obligations imposed on importers, the enforcement or lack of it, including record keeping and tracing, the very important issue of diversion, brokering, and the controversy over transfers to NSAs, non-state actors. I've actually written a piece about this, which I submitted to an IR journal. I haven't had a response to it. The issue of transfers to non-state actors is a really, really interesting and controversial one, but I'm going to skip that. A critical examination of the main articles of the treaty can only be undertaken in light of the reasons for its existence, whether and how effectively it addresses those problems that led to its creation. Now, there were seven factors, or seven diverse concerns, that lay behind movement for international regulation of the arms trade. I'm going to cut through this rather quickly for time reasons, but think of them as the seven deadly sins, and not all of them are addressed in the treaty. Firstly, there's the problem of small arms, light weapons, or SAW. Kofi Annan, when the UN Secretary General, described these as the real weapons of mass destruction. These are the things that are actually responsible for most of the deaths in the post-Cold War period. They're not defined in the treaty, which incidentally lacks a definitional section generally. But the most widely used definition includes revolvers, self-loading pistols, rifles, assault rifles, submachine, light and heavy machine guns, and the launchers for anti-tank things, the so-called manpads, which you've probably seen in 100 films. Now, the movement towards the control of the traffic in SAW began in the UN in the 1990s, when Boutros Ghali picked up on the idea of post-war, post-Cold War disarmament to extend it to what he called micro-disarmament. He and Annan were Africans. They were probably more sensitive than their predecessors to carnage that SAW was largely responsible for, and they could not fail to notice that they were all manufactured in northern states and imported. So the issue of controlling the transfer of arms got caught up in the UN, and this was reinforced by the fact that northern NGOs, many of them devoted to development, lobbied in support for a restriction on arms transfers because they'd seen the effects of SAW at first hand. They also highlighted the fact that the overwhelming majority of those who died in conflict zones are civilians, and most of these are women and children. And thus, the aim of reducing civilian deaths led inescapably to restrictions on transfer of weapons, and entwined with that are concerns about development and violence against women and children. Secondly, weapons manufactured in northern democracies have been used repeatedly in violent suppression of dissent in the political orders of recipient states. Now, this doesn't sit very well with all the propaganda, really, but from northern states about spreading democracy and human rights throughout the world. And so there is this contradiction. There's a political scientist in the States who talks about organized hypocrisy, which is what this really is. And so therefore, governments have been under pressure from NGOs and the media in some cases to cut back on the supply. Now, there are supposedly in EU states and in the USA legislation which incorporates various restrictions relating to things like human rights abuses, which tend to be followed at best partially and infrequently. Now, most of these states, particularly within the EU, not the USA, were advocates of the arms trade treaty. You know, whether their policies or conduct will change significantly now that they have adhered to a treaty which they had supported and some had strongly advocated, is a purely empirical question and one of great importance. Now, the third point, which I want to stress a bit, given that this is a student audience, is that the arms trade is often accused of contributing to death and misery by encouraging and facilitating warfare. This is an empirical claim. It's not a normative one. Underlying it are a host of questions. Does the receipt of arms encourage aggression that leads to war, or discourage it by achieving or restoring military balance? Does it encourage diplomatic combativeness but not armed conflict? Does the effect depend on volume, timing, the specific political circumstances, or a combination of some or all of these? Does the effect vary significantly depending upon whether the recipient is a state or an NSA? How important is the character of the NSA? All these questions have been subject to several studies which produce results that are quite inconclusive. And it's a subject that cries out loudly for deeper and especially more contemporary research, because the empirical stuff was all done during the Cold War period, or retrospectively of the Cold War period. And any of you who are searching around for a defil thesis, this is an ideal topic, in my opinion. That's why I say I want to emphasize it here. The fourth, and of course, whatever scholarship may reveal. Supplier states have uniformly shared the view that in circumstances where a fresh infusion of arms is likely to encourage aggression or armed conflict, none should be supplied, as this is unwelcome to participants or would-be participants in armed conflict. The problem of getting around restrictions becomes fundamental, hence the importance of eliminating black market sales. Issues around preventing covert illegal shipments, the regulation of arms brokers and other intermediaries, and most important, preventing diversion of weapons from the ostensible purchaser to the other parties, then arise inescapably. And this becomes a very practical question of enforcement. The treaty and any legal instrument is only the bare bones of what's really going to be important. Preventing diversion is an important aim for exporting states for more self-interested reasons as well. Summarized in a single word, blowback. You sell stuff to A, get shot back at your soldiers 5 years down the line. We had a great scandal in this country in the early 90s called the Matrix, grew out of something called the Matrix Churchill trial, the whole arms for Iraq affair, which is basically arms that were sold to Jordan but were actually ending up with Saddam Hussein. They were machine tools and they were very readily converted into weapons, and which ended up being directed at British troops and American in Gulf War I. Today the concern is more about whether the arms will find their way into the hands of so-called terrorists. I don't need to get into the very politically contentious issue of what terrorism is or is not, since states have never been able to agree a definition of it. But it's clear that at least some organizations that essentially commit horrific violence against civilians qualify for definition of that. And there is, of course, the problem about different groups in complicated situations like Syria, where the weapons are supposed to be going to A but end up in the hands of B. This whole question of preventing that happening becomes part of the agenda of trying to control arms transfer. Fifth, the arms trade has been tainted by deep and widespread corruption. So much so that it has even been argued that for some states, corruption is the purpose of arms purchases. Those in position of great power authorize acquisitions of equipment not genuinely needed for defense in order to profit from the bribes, commissions, contracts, or related services, and other lucrative opportunities. There have been some very good stuff done by South Africans, actually. It's been an ongoing scandal in South Africa for nearly 20 years about all this. But that's only one particularly well-documented example. It is less commonly realized that arms trade corruption may also be deeply damaging to the governance of the exporting countries. As governments refuse to comply with normal forms of legislative accountability and even manage successfully to close off the judicial system to those who seek to cast light on criminal activity undertaken with official knowledge or even by public officials directly. This is how I got into my interest in the arms trade in the 90s with the Scott Inquiry, with a number of other things. And if any of you are interested in how this can pollute the judicial system, take a look at the so-called Corner House case in the House of Lords in 2008 and compare it with the Divisional Court's response, and you get a very clear sense of what I'm talking about. Six, although the connection is by no means always present, concerns about corruption in purchasing states are often tightly linked to impoverishment of poor countries who purchase weapons well beyond their means. Now, although they're supposed to be in the so-called EU common position, a restriction on this, they talk about something seriously hampering the sustainable development of the recipient country. Corruption in arms purchases as a factor in the continuing impoverishment of poor nations has long been recognized as a major scandal. Yet attempts by northern states, often former colonial rulers, to refuse to permit sales on this ground risk by duplicative charges of neo-colonialism. Hence, any attempt to include a sustainable development criterion in any international agreement regulating the arms trade involves fierce controversy, and this came up in the ATT negotiations, and there's also this intertwining of corruption and sustainable development as relevant factors. And finally, civilian gun violence is a major problem in some states. It is no accident that Mexico was one of the main proponents of the ATT, because you've got the lucrative American drugs market, you've got guns which flow around the United States like water, which get down into Mexico, and the result is simply carnage. And Mexico has been trying to deal with this, very unsuccessfully as it happens, but pushed to the ATT in part to deal with this. They were supported by states like Trinidad and Tobago and the rest of the CARICOM states, which also have addressed the problem of civilian gun violence. Now, the historical background, the ATT, has been covered in a number of well-written sources, and I won't go into that here, except to do it in a very skeletal sort of way. December 2006, you had a UN General Assembly resolution setting up telling the Secretary General to set up a committee of experts. The United States, this was Bush administration, was the sole vote against it. But, and this prefigured what was going to happen later on, important states like Russia, China, and India abstained. The governing committee was set up, the governing expert group was set up. It was chaired by a very important person who's kind of drifted out of public view, called Roberto Garcia Martin, who was an Argentine lawyer and diplomat. He chaired the three PrepCom sessions, and then the last one in July 2011 produced a paper, which was the kind of foundation of all the negotiations that happened. The first set took place in New York in the summer of 2012. They were undertaken from the beginning on the basis that the result had to be agreed by consensus, unanimity. They then went on for 3 weeks. It looked like they had a text. The last minute, the US pulled the plug and said that more study was needed. Now, at the time, this was seen as a great betrayal. In fact, we probably got a better text in 2013 than the 2012 text. More importantly, it allowed the United States eventually to sign, because if you think about the timing of this, summer 2012, presidential election coming up in November. The last thing the Obama administration wanted to do was put its head into a noose of the gun lobby. And there are three parts of the treaty which said specifically we're not going to interfere with anything that happens domestically, but the gun nuts in the United States don't pay any attention to this. I'm sorry, the National Rifle Association. and it would have been very damaging electorally. The Obama people knew this, and they kicked the thing into the long grass. It came back in March 2013 and lasted for 3 weeks. Didn't, as I say, get consensus. There were three opponents. But it then became a UN GA resolution a week later. And that's the document that is now in force and has attracted, I forget how many ratifications, but there's a website where you can follow this. Now, before looking at the specifics, a couple of general observations are required in order to understand both how certain specific articles took shape and also the limitations of support for the treaty. And this last point's the key one. There were, as I say, only three recorded opponents, but the dissenters cover almost half the world's population. You've got China, India, Indonesia, Russia, and Egypt for a start. Most of the Arab world, including nearly all the oil-rich countries, and all five of the Latin American states with left-wing governments. Thus, the claim that the treaty expresses overwhelming international opinion is something of an illusion. And remember, Russia's the world's second largest exporter. China's going up that ladder all the time. India's by far the largest importer. It's displaced Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states in that rather dubious league table very recently. So the key international actors on both sides of the trade remain unenthusiastic at best. There are also several notable divisions between exporting and importing states and significant differences in the importance various states and regional groups attach to the various contentious issues that emerge in the negotiations. Now, some states in the USA is most public and explicit. It's amazing what you can do if you're a superpower. If you just tell everybody, this is what we're going to take, and this is what we're not going to take. And everybody else is basically stuck. I mean, the Americans in some ways are quite obnoxious about the positions they take, but they're honest. And they don't know which is better and which is worse. At least you know who you're dealing with and what you're dealing with. And they said, they issued a document in 2010 saying, these are the red lines. You know, if you want us on board, which in something like this, the USA is by far the world's largest arms exporter, if you want something like this to work, it's got to have the USA on board. Basically, you're doing it on their terms. Now, that's not to say they didn't compromise, but they just made very clear in a way that, say, the Czech Republic or even the UK could not. that these are just certain things that aren't going to be there if you want to see them. Many others wanted the treaty to go further in various ways, but were forced to accept more modest measures if the key states were to be kept on board. No one, state or NGO, was fully satisfied with the compromises that emerged. Whether acceptance of half a loaf, or perhaps even a lesser quantity, was the mark of good judgment or an abandonment of principle is something that can only be properly assessed in perhaps a decade, when the treaty has had a reasonable time to make its mark. Now, I want to go now into the treaty. How am I doing for time, by the way? And talk about the two central pillars, and that's what's been distributed to you. Start with the scope, which is Article 2, and to a lesser extent Article 3, which is the contentious and complex. So this is concerning what equipment comes within the treaty, and this fits with its definition of conventional arms. Now here the result is disappointing, because early in the evolution of the ATT, the scope was narrowed significantly. The chairman's draft that I mentioned was broad-ranging. It had 12 categories in it. What's emerged is the 8 that are there before you. The only one that the strong proponents for stronger treaty made sure they got through was small arms and light weapons. If they hadn't, the CARICOM states and most of the African states wouldn't have signed, and the whole thing would have been completely useless. So you've got what used to be the 7 on the UN register plus small arms and light weapons. What has been excluded? Ammunition, parts and components, unarmed aircraft and helicopters, small caliber artillery systems, and what Chairman Loretan had described as technology and equipment specially and exclusively designed to develop or manufacture the weapons. Now, the shortening of this list occurred in July 2012 session. What emerged is being identical. These categories, as I say, had a clear origin in the UN Register of Conventional Arms. This register was established in 1991, and reflecting the concerns of that era, is limited to heavy weaponry. It also reflects the state of technology of a generation ago, even though weapons development has since progressed rapidly. This provenance contributes to the major shortcomings of the list, and I'll identify 3. The first one, and the least important, as they say in a different context, size matters. The issue here is how small is too small for purposes of being a small arm or light weapon. If it's not small, it's something else, presumably it's ammunition. And the most important thing here is grenades, which don't fit they're not big enough to be small arms. The other thing that might have been important is landmines, but almost all the ATT signatories have signed up to the Ottawa Convention, though the USA has not. The second shortcoming has to do with purpose. In place of all military vehicles, as Chairman Moratan proposed, the treaty covers only armored combat and attack versions of this equipment. That's vehicles, helicopters, and aircraft. The most obvious result is to exclude anything used for training, since helicopters bought as training equipment can, without great difficulty, be refitted to engage in combat. This is a significant loophole, since helicopter gunships are featured prominently in attacks on civilians in places like East Timor in the independence conflict. Excluding vehicles that are not armored allows unregulated and unaccounted for transfers of transport vehicles readily used to move troops to a battle area or to centers of political opposition where issues of human rights abuses readily occur. And although drones and other planes capable of releasing bombs would count as combat aircraft, the weapons would be, they're increasingly common use as unarmed vehicles for the surveillance of target populations and the gathering of intelligence of all kinds would fall outside the treaty. This is a particularly acute example of the most serious weakness of the purpose limitation. It completely excludes whole classes of equipment whose impact, particularly on internal dissent, advances the repression and violence caused by actual weaponry. This is seen most clearly in relation to surveillance equipment. The problem of the use by dictatorial regimes of various forms of sophisticated technology to track individuals and intercept communications came to the fore during the Arab Spring, when people realized what the governments of Tunisia and Egypt and Libya were doing. Both the UK Committee on Arms Exports and the Wassenaar Arrangement, which is a basically a kind of arms control group founded about 20 years ago to control arms proliferation, recommended the extension of licensing requirements to surveillance equipment and software. Now, they could speak and act in this manner because, unlike the ATT, their remit is not limited to a specified category of conventional arms. Surveillance equipment, because it has both civilian and military uses, is classified as dual-use goods. And if any of you are EU lawyers, this is a completely different set of regimes in terms of weapons and dual-use goods. But it's also true at the international level as well. Such goods can, with varying degree of difficulty, be converted from their original or ostensible civilian application to military use. This is what happened in Gulf War I. But dual-use goods and technology have always been outside the intended scope of all proposed global regulation, a self-imposed limitation that has curtailed at the outset the ability to protect people and to advance human security, which is, after all, what this enterprise is supposed to be about. Now, the limitation of the ATT to specified categories of conventional arms plainly fails to cover surveillance equipment. At present, this is perhaps its most serious omission of scope. But looking towards the future, greater ones can be identified. Technology per se is outside the treaty entirely. Although, as I said, Chairman Mauritania was at least partly aware of this problem, his proposal didn't cover the whole thing. And it was quashed at the beginning and just vanished after that. In the result, for example, guidance systems for weapons unquestionably coming under the ATT are now excluded. And on the near horizon, if not indeed already with us, technology for cyber warfare, in which the technology itself is the weapon, and on a further horizon, autonomous weapons fall wholly outside the treaty as well. Now, inevitably with any treaty, or indeed in any form of legal regulation, there's a huge socio-legal literature about this, there is always the likelihood that technological change will make some of the legal categories outmoded. However, technological development moves particularly rapidly in the military field, and since amendments cannot be proposed until at the earliest 6 years after it comes into force, so we're talking about the beginning of 2021, at the earliest, there is the likelihood, and it is very much more than a possibility, that possession of internationally uncontrolled items may proliferate in this decade. The one practical restriction is that most of the cyber and AW technology is classified as highly secret by governments which now possess them, so no transfers will take place for reasons of strict national interest. But this does not apply to surveillance equipment, and the need to go beyond the current definition of conventional arms is inescapable if the treaty state concerns about human rights, which are scattered throughout the treaty, are to be given practical effect. However, the matters that I've just covered in relation to scope were not the primary focus of controversy during the negotiations. The single most contentious issue was going to be the treatment of ammunition. The overwhelming number of states were in favor of this from all different parts of the world, including the EU states. But they encountered unmoving opposition from Russia, China, India, Malaysia, but most vocally from the USA. The American stance was the target of the greatest anger by proponents of a stronger treaty. But in PR terms, criticism of the other opponents was deflected because they took shelter under the US umbrella. As often happens in major international negotiations, the US position prevailed, though only in part, and this was inevitable given both American power and the consensus principle. Now, I'm going to skip over. There is some validity to the American concern, which basically had to do with record keeping. Just remember the following fact. There is somewhere between 300 and 320 million people in the United States that is roughly the same number of guns in civilian ownership. And they import 2.5 billion cartridges of ammunition every year, and they were really worried about the record keeping problems about. They have apparently insatiable desire, not only for guns, but for the ammunition. And if they were going to take it seriously, they were going to have to engage in all kinds of administrative controls and records, which were exactly what were politically toxic and probably impossible in terms of getting legislation through for any American regime. What you've got instead, and you've got in front of you, is Article 3, which is a dedicated provision dealing with ammunition, which says, essentially, this is the key bit, that each party shall regulate its ammunition by means of a national control system and applies Article 6 and 7 to it. do the key provisions on export apply equally to ammunition and every other form of conventional arms in Article 2? The compromise was that the provisions on imports, brokering, diversion, and record keeping don't apply to ammunition. That was what deal was struck, to keep the USA on board. It doesn't, however, prevent, explicitly doesn't prevent, the fact that you can have voluntary cooperation in relation to transfer of ammunition between states that is more rigorous than what the treaty proclaims. Now, just a quick overall assessment of scope. The treatment of ammunition falls short of what a lot of people wanted, but the most important substantive duties created by the treaty do apply, and it may be that less has been sacrificed than has been feared. What bothers me a lot more is not only the refusal to include training and transport equipment, but the failure to include weapons technology and surveillance equipment. I think it's going to be a big loophole in the next decade or so. Now, if I can move swiftly, and I do have my eye on the clock here, to talk about the substantive obligations and where, it's essentially the crux of the treaty. These break down between the bans or prohibitions in Article 6 and the export assessment procedures in Article 7. And I want to look at two parts of Article 6. 6.1, which forbids authorization of transfers that would violate measures adopted by the UN Security Council under Article 7, in particular arms embargoes, which of course have been of increasing frequency in the last couple of decades. Now this would forbid transfers by any state even though it voted against it in the Security Council or if one of the P5 abstained. Whether that will actually affect the likelihood of proposed embargoes being vetoed in the Security Council by one of the P5 is a bit academic at the moment since Russia and China haven't signed the treaty, but it might arise as a problem later on. But the most controversial part of Article 6 is in Article 6.3, which forbids transfers by a state party if it has knowledge, I'm emphasizing this, at the time of authorization. So this is about knowledge and contemporaneous knowledge, that the weapons would be used in the commission of certain defined evils. Now, although I'm going to offer a critique of this, this text is unquestionably an improvement over what was there in 2012. And in a way, I'm glad the Americans kicked it into the long grass at that point. The least satisfactory element is this requirement of contemporaneous knowledge that the equipment would be used for barbaric purposes. Now, the commentary to the articles on state responsibility, the ILC, discusses the complexities of attribution and includes inevitably, but not, I feel, very helpfully, that whether attribution is subjective or objective must depend on a particular circumstance. Now, in criminal law, the knowledge or scienter issue is always informed by the realization that a purely subjective test would permit ignorance, willful or inadvertent, to be the escape route from liability. And the problem is often addressed by a formulation such as that D knows or ought to have known or knows or has reasonable cause to believe. This introduces an element of objective or external judgment, but is not an excessively demanding standard. And a formulation such as knows or has reasonable cause to believe would not have been excessively rigorous and would have been preferable, bearing in mind in particular that virtually all states devote considerable resources to obtaining foreign intelligence, and most of the big ones, including the arms exports, have dedicated intelligence agencies that are supposed to be doing this. And it would have been more reasonable, I think, to impose upon them some responsibility to be aware of violent conflict in states or impending violent conflict or in areas where approval of a weapons sale is being sought, and to insist that they take some steps to satisfy themselves that the transfer would not contribute to grave evils. An additional serious shortcoming is that the danger has to be direct and immediate, that the time of authorization the arms or items would be used. This literally means that so long as the recipient is not clearly about to commit some great atrocity, the prohibition can be avoided, even if the recipient's intention is clear and the capacity is being built up. This seems to have got lost in the negotiations. I saw no mention of this at all in any of the blogs, the NGOs, or anything else that was going on. And it's a big gap, in my opinion. Moreover, such judgment would be based on information available at the time of authorization. There is no mention of a party's obligation when information indicating possible misuse is obtained subsequently. And at present, it's common practice for export authorizations to be suspended or revoked in light of developments, and the treaty should have required this as well. Now, the evils singled out in Article 6.3 for particular avoidance, most of them are reasonably well defined and understood. Crimes against humanity, war crimes in the Rome Statute. The inclusion of crimes against humanity ensures that severe brutality against states' own citizens come within the prohibited sphere. Particularly valuable is the specific mention of attacks directed against protected civilians and civilian objects. Now, whilst common Article 3 of the 1949 Convention does offer some protections to civilians in cases of non-international armed conflict, these are supplemented considerably by additional Protocol 2 of 1977. Thus, the treaty absolutely prohibits all transfers to governments or NSAs which have attacked civilians or civilian objects like schools or refugee camps in civil wars or other internal conflict. This, I believe, is a major advance for international law. And the expanded definitions of what are considered civilians and civilian objects in international armed conflict, which is found in AP1, are now reinforced and enforced by the ATT in that exporters are banned from transferring weapons to states which do not respect them. Yet since the contours and content of those definitions have proven extraordinarily controversial, states which reject the ICRC's interpretation of those who may be legitimately targeted will presumably also construe their treaty obligations accordingly. I'm thinking about the USA and Israel particularly. And finally, the sweeper-up category of other war crimes, clear allusion to Article 8 of the Rome Statute. But a state implementing the ATT need only take account of war crimes as defined in international agreements to which it is a party, it says there, which means the very large number of important states which have either not signed or ratified the Rome Statute, with all the usual suspects, need not do so. And of course, this would apply a fortiori to Article 8 bis on aggression, which has even fewer signatures. And then we get to the export assessment under Article 7, which is actually going to be much more important in frequency terms, because the actions engaged by the prospective purchaser may not be so obviously repugnant. So there's this two-stage process. You first see whether Article 6 applies. If it doesn't, then a more complex, rather malleable set of factors set out in Article 7 are to be applied. And these are expressed in terms of balance or overall assessment. This leaves wide latitude for decisions based on political, economic, or other factors which are irrelevant and may well be contrary to the objects and purposes of the treaty. Even before these factors are considered, exporters are enjoined to apply them in, quote, an objective and non-discriminatory manner. That phrase appears no less than three times in different parts of the treaty, which emphasizes both its importance and its contentiousness. Many of the states which were severely critical of the treaty were most scathing about its failure to curb the exporters, to curb the ability of exporters to apply its restrictions selectively. You got what Hart called open textured provisions here, which allow pretty wide range of possibilities of biased decisions whilst ostensibly applying it in good faith. And this aspect, above all, which is aggravated by the absence of a definitional section or a creation of an interpretive organ under the treaty, was cited by states like India in their stern critique of what they termed an exporting treaty. Now, on the assessment, I am running out of time, aren't I? Just a few significant points. What's supposed to be assessed is the potential that the weaponry would contribute or undermine international peace and security. The language of potential alerts one to the reality that the decision is one of prediction. The problem about Article 7.1a, about contributing or undermining, leaves open the argument that by sending weapons to a state, you restore the balance of power, and therefore you're actually, arms transfers are contributing to peace. Now, there may be circumstances where that's true, but it lies so easily and self-interestedly in the mouth of exporters that I regard it as a very dangerous thing to include it. My understanding is that the Americans insisted on it during the negotiation. Certainly, it also, if something is felt to undermine peace and security, it shouldn't even be considered if membership in the UN means anything at all to the exporter. And therefore, I think should have gone into Article 6 in the actual ban or prohibition section, but it didn't. Now we get to Article 7.1b. The four consequences have to be assessed. The two that cause the greatest controversy are that the weapons could be used to commit or facilitate a serious violation of IHL or of IHRL. The reference to IHRL is particularly welcome because of the use of imported weapons for internal repression. Taken seriously, it would bar sales to virtually every Arab state. Inclusion of IHL, also a potential flashpoint, again taken seriously, would bar supply of weapons to Israel. Using these highly contentious examples shows both the radical implications of requiring exporters to assess these issues and also the political difficulty and perhaps unreality of expecting rigorous application. Now, having considered these risks, the exporter should then consider whether there are measures that could mitigate them. This is not a particularly controversial provision. And having assessed that and considered the available mitigating measures, the fundamental decision that must be taken, which is Article 7.3, commands that if the exporting state determines that there is an overriding risk of those negative consequences, it shall not authorize the export. This overriding risk language is the single most debated phrase throughout the whole set of negotiations. It was not, or at any rate should not have been understood to be, about the gravity of the result. That's addressed in the business about serious breach. The likelihood, could is the word used, is not sufficiently reduced. Then the transfer should be forbidden. To say that there is an overriding risk of such a likelihood reads rather awkwardly as a matter of English grammar. The word that approximates most closely what was intended is overwhelming. And that's a very easy threshold. That is to say, you have to have such strong evidence or belief that this is going to happen before you bar the test. And this is why it was such a contentious phrase. The USA insisted on this. Russia and China ducked under the umbrella. I think they were backing the USA on this point and weren't honest enough to admit it. In the end, the Americans, who apparently dug in their heels, prevailed. I think this sends out entirely the wrong message to states which are now setting up domestic standards for export controls. I'm thinking about places like Brazil, South Africa, places that are developing their own arms industries and will start exporting in the next 5 to 10 years. Overriding risk makes it far too easy for a state to approve a transfer whilst claiming compliance with the treaty. Now, there were attempts to get sustainable development and corruption in there. They failed on this neo-colonialism point. And all I would say to that, there was nothing colonialistic, neo or otherwise, about this, because an acceptance of such a limitation would have had no possible economic or political gains to the exporting states, very possibly short-term losses. But the sovereignty flag was waived. But it was really about the sovereignty of states that were authoritarian and determined to shore up their rule by force, plus states like India, which have seemed to have been some kind of injection against any kind of international agreement that limits their ability to do anything in international relations. And they were very important in the debate. And I just, given the time pressure, want to offer one concluding thought, which is that the baton's been now been passed from international lawyers and diplomats to administrative lawyers and public administrators to make this work. Because this is now about integrating an international agreement into the domestic legal and administrative systems of various states. That's going to require a lot of capacity building among both central government, police, and customs authorities. It's going to require heavy work, anti-corruption. It's going to require education in things like what is an end-user certificate, which somebody in a place like Cote d'Ivoire will probably never have seen, or understand, but needs to have it explained to them in terms of worrying about diversion. And the long, this is, people have to go into this in the long haul, but it's going to be done in fairly obscure, low-profile domestic stuff. It's not now a matter for primacy, anyway, at the international law, although there will be efforts to kind of monitor what's going on. But it's in the home countries where this is now going to have its effect, if it has an effect at all. Thank you.